introducing the speaker this evening. He's not a complete stranger to me, although the first time I met Jim, I built up one tremendous resentment. Several years ago, he and I appeared on an anniversary program together. I don't know if we rolled the dice, set the card, flipped the coin, or whether the group that invited us decided, but we split the program, and I had the first half, and he had the second half.
And I resented it because I had to go first, because that limited my time. I couldn't talk as long as I wanted to, because they were holding the watch on me. Then after I sat down, I resented him even more because he said everything in the second half that I wanted to say in the first half. But that's the way Jim and I got started. And I've known him for some little time. I'm not going to try and tell his story because I think we do a speaker a tremendous disservice. If we say anything more, then he's a swell guy and a swell AA. And I've been watching the door, Jim, to be sure that everybody got in, and I think they're all in now, and I'm going to let you have it. Jim H., your speaker for this evening.
I thought I was the only one that had any resentment that Sunday that we were together. Bob, that has been quite a few years ago. My name is Jim Hawkins, and I'm an alcoholic. Member of the Bessemer Group, Bessemer, Alabama. I haven't found it necessary to take a drink or a pill since December the 8th, 1955. I had the golden opportunity a couple of 3 years ago to have an opportunity to talk at the Top of Texas Roundup. One of my very good friends, or a guy that got to be one of my very good friends, got up out there to introduce the speaker. He says, "My name is Whistler Wilson, and I haven't found it necessary to take a drink in 2 years. He went ahead and introduced his speaker and sat down, and some old boy he'd been working with was sitting next to him and told him, said, "Whistler, you was drunk 2 weeks ago." He says, "Yeah, but by God, that wasn't necessary." I wasn't drunk 2 weeks ago, 2 months ago, but I've had a lot of trouble since I've been in this program. I haven't drank since December the 8th, 1955, but I have a lot of trouble keeping Jim Hawkins straight, keeping him in the road, or keeping him lined up. Because if I was responsible, and if I was dependent 12 and a half years ago, then I'm 10 times more dependent and more responsible tonight than I was then. Because this thing has done so much to us and my family. And before I get too far along, I'm one of the used Kleenex boys over in Alabama. I'm an ex-delegate. And after you serve as delegate, then you're nothing anymore. They kind of shove you aside. But my wife is the delegate over there now for Al-Anon. And I'm real fastly becoming known as Mickey's husband. I want my wife to stand up, Mickey, if you will. She's been an awful lot to my sobriety. She had a lot to do with my sobriety. And we hear the Al-Anon so many times get up and say they were in worse shape than we were. Well, my wife is still in worse shape than I am, because she's married to me. That's what makes it worse. We came to this program in March of 1955, but wasn't quite ready. Had to do a little more experimenting and come back then in December of 1955. I've changed my opinion about a lot of things in AA since that time, and one of them is about the 12 steps. I've changed my opinion about those steps so much, and I'm not like a lot of the people that I know. I can't memorize them. Because when I first came to AA in March of 1955, I thought the only time my life was unmanageable was when I was drinking or when I was under the influence of alcohol. I would admit readily to you that I couldn't handle alcohol. But I probably wouldn't admit to you that I couldn't manage my life. But I have come to believe that this alcoholic could never manage his life, with or without alcohol. And it's a funny thing now, I notice a lot of times in our group, we start to talk about the first step. And some old boy will hop up and talk about how unmanageable his life was while he was drunk. That boy of mine's unmanageable all the time. Because I knew from the very beginning I couldn't handle alcohol. I knew this deep down within me. But it took so long for me to admit the fact that I could not manage my life. Because alcohol to me, in the beginning, was not a problem. It answered my problems. It gave me an easiness that I'd been searching for. Because from the beginning of time, as far as I'm concerned, and as far as any of us is concerned, time didn't start until we began. You know, if we really think of this, time began when we were born. And from the time of my beginning, I had problems. I had difficulty living with me and living with you, accepting you. Well, I couldn't accept you. I couldn't accept the things around me, the people, the things, the circumstances, the community. Couldn't accept any of these things. Nervous and scared to death, almost as scared as I am before I always try to make a talk. Not quite. But when I took a drink of alcohol at the age of about 13, 14, somewhere along there, all these things vanished from my mind, and I didn't have any anxieties and fears and frustrations or whatever you call them. So alcohol became a terrific tool in my life. Was very important to me. And I used this. I don't know where or when I got to the point I couldn't stop when I wanted to. I know I wouldn't admit it. I never admitted defeat until you found me. Certainly I was insane, like it tells us in our second step. And this was something hard for me to accept when I first came to AA, admitting insanity. But the step tells me that somewhere along the line I was sane at one time, because the step says, restore us to sanity. Restore us to sanity. came to believe in a power greater than ourselves could restore sanity. So if I had admitted sincerely, without any reservation, that my life is unmanageable, powerless over alcohol, then there has to be a power somewhere. And I found that power with you. It's a little difficult talking to you because all of you, there's so many people here that are so close to me. It's almost like talking to my own group. So many of you I've known so many years in AA, and it's the most difficult problem for anybody that I've ever heard talk to say that it, you know, to talk before their own group. You have to watch what you say in the first place, because they're going to compare with what you said the last time and see if you're lying. And they want to see if you've learned any new words, any of them six-bit words. Well, I haven't learned any six-bit words. I've just tried to stay sober through applying these principles and these steps to my life, to the very best of my ability. And that's all I have to do with the choice I have. I did all the things you did to all the people that I loved. I broke the hearts of all the ones that were close to me. I used everybody I came in contact with, just like you. I was thrown out of practically every school I ever attended after I took my first drink. I would probably have never got as far in school as I did if my father hadn't been on the school board. He could transfer me. I had all these things happen to me. I know what it is to sleep in the gutter. I knew what it was to sleep in an alley, flop house. I knew all of these things before I was a man, before I was 21 years old. I know what it is to live on Skid Row, because I was one of the ones that went all the way. All the way down. And I can't understand why I once heard a fellow say in AA that if he had believed in God as a youngster and in his development years or adolescent years, possibly if he'd have believed in God, he wouldn't have drank like he did. Possibly. And probably shocked some of you, but I think the reason I drank as hard as I did in the latter part of my drinking was because I did believe in God. Because I had been taught to believe in Him. I was taught the right way. And I had become the type of person I didn't want to be. And because of this, I condemned myself to a state where I didn't have any place else to go except to drink. Where can an alcoholic go? What can he do when he doesn't know anything else to do except go to the bottle? We have to get rid of this football in our middle. And we always knew that if we went back to the bottle, we could get rid of the football, this thing that keeps building and getting bigger and bigger in the middle. But there's one thing we never are able to get rid of. And that's this feeling we have in here. Because you see, all of us are blessed with a little piece of white velvet called a conscience. And if we're alcoholic, we can't stand ourselves because of what we are. If there is fault for what I have done, then the fault is mine. If there is fault for what I have done, then the fault is mine. But I don't believe there is. I don't believe there is, because I don't believe an alcoholic can suffer through what we suffered through. The frustrations and the loneliness and the hopelessness. And be held responsible for some of the things we did. Sure, it seems like outwardly, some of our outward actions against the people we love so much and against our families, our employers, and so forth, that we're nuts. But if you were like me, you didn't want to do these things. I believe we're striking out at people around us because we can't be like other people. I couldn't be like the people around me. I couldn't be what my father wanted me to be. My name went on my father's business less than a week from the day I was born. J.B. Hawkins and Son. It was his ambition for me to take over his business. I could have cared less. I didn't like his business. He was a leader in the community. But I couldn't be a leader in the community. He was a guy that did things. Constructive things. I couldn't do constructive things, and I resented it. I resented that. So I drank. I drank just like most other alcoholics because I couldn't be what I wanted to be and what I was expected to be. I had problems with my service. I was discharged from the Navy when they were taking you if you were warm. And we went through that spell, you know, where if you was warm, they'd take you. Well, that's when they got rid of me. Because they have certain regulations that you have to live up to. And I couldn't even do that. I was still a kid, of course. I was still a kid, probably still am, in a lot of ways. But, you know, I felt so remorseful because of this. I hung around a big city and tried to hide myself, tried to bury myself among people. And we all know how lonely we can be in a city of 7 million even. And this is one of the most frustrating feelings that we can have. Be among millions of people and feel so alone. Feel so alone. Some of the tragic things that I did, some of the people that I harmed so much, and this is so true in so many people I've come in contact with since coming to the program, are the ones that are so innocent, like our children, and like our family, like our wives and our parents and so forth. The people we blame for all of our problems. We always blame, of course, someone else. I went through all of these things, blaming all the other people around me. I was married very young the first time. An alcoholic marriage, I'm sure. A marriage that didn't last but a very short time. And I suppose that one of the greatest injustices that a judge could do when I got a divorce was to give me custody of our child. He gave me custody of a little girl that it took me 10 years to run her away from home. With my arrogance and my stupidity and my sickness. Because I blamed her for a lot of the things that had happened to me and her mother. It took me 10 years to drive her away from home. And then people will tell us, the people that love us so much and want to help us so much, will tell us, why do you do these things? And we wonder that, you know. We always wonder that. I don't believe I ever had anybody say to me before I came to AA, Jim, what do you think about your drinking? No one ever asked me what I thought about my drinking. You know, nobody ever asked me what I thought about anything. Nobody ever asked me what I thought about anything. And this is important to a human being, to be consulted about at least the weather. Well, we got an idea that we could run everything anyway, and nobody ever asks our opinion about anything. Now, everybody was always giving me their opinion about what they thought about Bundricky. What they thought about me and the things I did. But they didn't know that this was multiplied 10,000 times within the heart of me of how much I knew I was wrong. And they didn't know that I didn't know what to do about this. They didn't know that I didn't have but one thing to turn to. And that was a jug. Because with a jug for a certain length of time, I could release myself and relieve all of these feelings of loneliness and hopelessness, anxieties and all. And you know, we have to do this. We'd blow a gasket if we didn't. We'd blow a gasket. And you know, I stayed drunk after my first divorce. I continued to stay drunk and frequent the flop houses, the skid rows, the alleys, the doorways on West Madison Street in Chicago, or Embarcadero Street in San Francisco, or you name it, anywhere, it doesn't make any difference, any skid row in any city that I visited, and I visited a lot of them, and I always made it there. I always wound up there, and just a kid. But I remember that I came home to visit my little girl one Christmas. And my father and mother, my mother was raising my little girl because I wasn't doing anything to support her. Because after all, she was one of the things that had caused me to be like this. And I went back to Chicago on New Year's Eve day, this particular year, several years ago, of course. And I went out to a New Year's Eve party that night, a group of Southern people, my being a Southern boy. And I met a young lady that night, the one that I introduced to you tonight at the beginning of the meeting. And I'll say something now that I would never say, a big flat nose, two double-breasted, ugly son of a gun like me. I would have never said that I fell in love that night, but I did. I really did. And I wasn't drunk. I wasn't drunk that night. I fell in love with Mickey, and I wanted to marry her. I didn't love her enough to stop drinking. I didn't love her as much as I do now. But I convinced her after about a year that I was going to be a pretty good boy, and she consented to marry me, and then I give her about 10 or 11 years of the roughest hell that a person could have on earth. I took this fine young lady from a fine family in Middle Kentucky that had been raised had a wonderful background, and I drug her down to the lowest ebb of degradation. I started renting cheap apartments on the other side of town, jumping from job to job, moving from city to city. And every time I moved, I quit drinking. And every time I moved, she'd have to go to work to make a living. And then we had, over the next 3 years, we had two very wonderful daughters born to us. And, you know, the amazing thing about these wives that us Alkies managed to find, she couldn't hardly wait until she could meet Glenda, my daughter, my oldest daughter. She wanted to be a mother to her. It's amazing, isn't it? And she always was. She was the one that treated her like a daughter, and I was the one that treated her like an outsider, her own father. Now, you know if you're an Alkie, and if you're not an Alkie, you got an Alkie that you love or are crazy about, or you wouldn't be here. So that makes you the same. You know that I loved that child as much as it was humanly possible at this time. And I believe that I loved my wife and my other two children as much as it was humanly possible to love another human being. And I think the reason that I acted like I did, the reason I withdrew from these people, my three daughters and my wife and the people about me, the reason I withdrew from them is because I felt unworthy. I got to the point where I felt unworthy of clean, decent people because of the life I'd lived, because I did everything that you did. And I might have done a lot of other things that you didn't do. We had an old boy down at our club the other night that he used to come home drunk for been gone 2 weeks. And his wife would say, "Where you been?" He said, "I've been drunk." And that's a good answer. Because we all did the same things when we got drunk. And we didn't know what we did, but we did whatever drunks do. So why is there any use trying to explain what we did? Hell, I didn't know what I did most of the time. I'll tell you one thing, to be honest with you, and I might have one or two here that'll agree with me on this. I drank for a long time to get the guts to do the things I didn't have the guts to do without the drink. I wonder if there's anybody else like that. But you know, there comes a time in our life when we don't like to live like this. And unfortunately, when this time arrives in our lives, or when it arrived in my life, I couldn't do anything about it. I'd reached the point I couldn't stop anymore. There was no stopping. I had to have it to live. Or at least I thought that. It was just as strong as in my mind as if I had to have a drink of water. I had to have it. And I withdrew farther and farther from the people I loved and the people that loved me. And I had wonderful jobs just like you did. I had good, I had businesses like some of you did, and I lost them. And I lost my family a few times. You know, the amazing thing about this gal, though, my father had put me in business or helped me get in business, arranged some way for me to get in, or somebody would help me get a good job, and we'd do pretty good for a while and get a few bucks. And an alcoholic can't stand it, you know, to have a few bucks. A lot of us, including me, can't stand it now that I've been sober over 12 years. But then I'd go off on one of these 2 or 3 week tears, and I'm talking about a tear. One of them with a capital T. And come home broke, or lose my business, or lose my job. Now, when I was up, a lot of times I would lose my wife and my family. I'd get so lousy and low down. We operated a restaurant and a tavern in a small community. And we were the only one that had this type of business. I sold beer. And I sold beer legally. I sold other stuff illegally, but I sold beer legally. Now, I made a lot of money. I made a lot of money. And I got so lousy my wife left me. And then when I lost all of my money, lost my business, lost my lost everything, then she took me back. That never did make sense to me. She was trying to help me. That's what she was trying to do. And you know, I was withdrawing further and further into this shell that we draw into. I had a job. I worked for one company about 7.5 years. That was about the longest time I ever worked for anybody. They transferred me a lot. They made me sales manager a lot of times. No, they didn't make me sales manager a lot of times. They made me supervisor a lot of times. I don't think they ever made me general sales manager but once. I always dreamed they would a lot of times. I was working for a New York firm. I had started with them up in Indiana, and I came down to Birmingham and went with them. And we opened a plant there in Birmingham. And this is after I'd been with them about 5 years. And to appreciate all of the times they had fired me at least 50, 60 times and hired me back. But I remember on several occasions I had been promoted to route supervisor. And I never did get to fill this job, not too long this time because I'd have to celebrate. But one Thursday afternoon, I came in off of a route. I'd been riding with a fella. I was route supervisor. We'd been doing a little drinking that day. We'd done a little drinking almost every day by this time. There was a little fella from up in Rochester, New York, and a big Irishman from Cincinnati, Ohio, and myself were the supervisory staff of the sales force, and we were all three alcoholics. One of them was the plant manager. In fact, he had some stock in the plant. And this big Irishman, he was, I suppose he was as, if there's any such thing as a good alcoholic while they're drinking. I guess he was about as good a one as I was. He had been fired from one of the big breweries trying to drink them out of business. And he'd gone to work for this firm, and we were working for one of the largest liquor importers in the country. We were in the beverage division of this company, a mixer. We was in the mixer business, really, working the nightclubs and the country clubs and the bars, and this is a lovely place to work, you know, in and out of those bars. But anyway, to get back to what I was going to tell you, I came in off of this route, and Jerry made the great announcement that night that starting tomorrow, Jim's going to be general sales manager. And I always liked that general, you know. And he also said several other nice things about me that I knew I deserved. And he called me off after the meeting, after the sales meeting, and he says, Jim, I'm going to send you to Tuscaloosa tomorrow. I want you to ride down there with Brian. Brian Henshaw was the boy I was going to go with the next day and teach him how to sell. Now, you know what Jerry told me? He says, Jim, stay reasonably sober. That's all he said. Stay reasonably sober. And he knew I'd do a good job if I did. I know I'm a salesman. I know I'm a salesman. If I hadn't have been, I wouldn't have sold myself on a lot of people and a lot of things. I think all Alkies is a top-notch con artist. So a good con artist is a good salesman. So he says, tonight, says you and Jerry, you and Brian get together and go over your day's work for tomorrow. Plan your day so you can go out and do an effective job tomorrow. So after the meeting, I got Brian, and we went about four doors down the street to Joe's to plan our day. Joe's, of course, was the local tavern. And at 3, 4, 5 o'clock the next morning, Joe, of course, this was a kind of a private bar for us around in that neighborhood. About 3 or 4 o'clock the next morning, we were still down at Joe's planning our day. And I knew if we didn't get the equipment out of the warehouse before the boss got down, he wouldn't let us go out in the condition we were in. I had sense enough to know that we was pretty drunk. So we got the truck out, and we went by to pick up the helper that we used on this drink truck. His name was Charlie. And these names, I want you to I'll mention these names, and they're very important in the story. Charlie was a Negro boy, a good boy. He liked to drink, of course, and so did Brian, and so did Jim. But I was the boss, you know, then, at least with these two guys. So we got the truck out of the warehouse, we picked up Charlie and started towards Tuscaloosa, and there was one little mistake, you know, made in this arrangement, because I had prior to this, had bought a new automobile. And we all like to show off, of course, and this doesn't cease after we get into AA. I had bought this bright yellow automobile, and it was the longest one you could buy, the biggest one. And I wanted to drive it to Tuscaloosa to show all those merchants and customers down there how prosperous I was, since I was general sales manager. I was supposed to be riding in the truck with Brian and Charlie, and I was following along behind him in the car. And about every couple of blocks, I'd blow my horn, and he'd pull over. And after the first time, he knew what I wanted. He'd pull over, come back to the car, we'd have a couple of drinks, plan our day a little more. He'd get back in the truck, he'd drive four blocks, I'd blow the horn, he'd stop real quick, come back to the car, we'd have a couple of drinks, plan our day. Bessemer's about 11 miles south of Birmingham towards Tuscaloosa. We had left Birmingham early that morning. And along about 11 o'clock or noon or something like that, we had reached Bessemer. And I told him, I said, we ain't going to make it today like this. We're going to have to make some kind of arrangement. And then I had a brilliant idea. Why don't you ride in the car with me? And Charlie had more sense than both of us. He says, Mr. Hawkins, you know that the helpers are not supposed to drive the trucks. This is a rule. I assured him that he was working for me. I was general sales manager, practically manager of the whole works. And he could go ahead and drive that truck, and there wouldn't be anything said about it because I'd fix it when we got back, if there was anything said about it. But he says, I haven't got any driver's license. And then I had another brilliant idea. I looked at Brian and I looked at Charlie, and they were about the same size. And I told Brian, I said, give him yours. Said, sure. He reached and got his driver's license and gave him to Charlie. And that's the way we sent him to Tuscaloosa with this truckload of merchandise, an expensive piece of equipment. I don't know what time we got to Tuscaloosa, but we did. And when we got there, Charlie was drunk. Brian had snuck a couple of pints of liquor in the truck, and I didn't know anything about it. Charlie had found it and got drunk, so we got to Tuscaloosa. I give Charlie enough money to buy gas to get back to Birmingham, fill the truck up to get back to Birmingham, and I told him that Brian and I were going to make a little trip. You see, on the way to Tuscaloosa, and all night prior to this trip, Brian had been telling me about his farm. He lived 15 miles east of Birmingham. He had 5 acres of land and a cow and a calf on this farm. And it had started to grow. And by the time we got into the suburbs of Tuscaloosa, he was running a tremendous herd of whiteface out there. He had a ranch that would equal King Brothers in Texas. He needed a partner. He needed stock. And there ain't no alcoholic going to get ahead of another. Never. I knew where there was plenty of stock to buy, and I had the money. So I bought into the business that morning. Of course, there wasn't any cash passed, you know, but I bought into the business. Big operation. So we told this boy to take the truck back to the warehouse and check it in. Brian and I were going to Arkansas to buy some cattle. And the boy ain't even supposed to be driving the truck, and he's drunk. And we haven't called on a customer. We haven't sold the first piece of merchandise. And once in a while, for the next 2 weeks, I would wonder what had happened, you know, when he got back. You know, I'd come to myself, and I'd say, I wonder what Jerry did when that old boy got back with that truck. Sometime late that night. Of course, I found out. We didn't get to Arkansas. We didn't get no cattle, of course. We was leaving Tuscaloosa, and we checked the map for the highway to get over to Memphis. And we got on the right highway. We got on the wrong end of it. And wound up down in Mississippi. toured the coast while we were down there. I was going to wind up going to Arkansas later. But somewhere down in Mississippi, we wrapped that automobile around a bridge down there, brand new car. I don't know why it is, but seems like always when there's a narrow bridge, in some of these highways, we got a lot of them in Alabama, and they got, I believe, more of them in Mississippi than we have. At the bottom of a hill, there's a narrow bridge. It's at the bottom of every one of them. And we were probably going as fast as the car would go. I don't know how much it would do. But I came to, we were both asleep, and we were the only two in there. That's not a good arrangement. I came to within probably several yards, it looked like inches, of this concrete abutment of this bridge. Something said turn left, or pull to the left. I was headed right towards that concrete abutment on that bridge. I pulled that car to the left, and we skidded through this bridge sideways, leaving a fender and a trunk and a bumper and several other things. But we went through that bridge. And the only thought I had, no thought of gratitude for being able to get through there, no, not one ounce of serenity within my heart for being saved or for being spared, because we all know what would have happened if I'd have hit that concrete button head on. The only thought I had was how bad have I tore up my automobile. That's the only thought I had. We gathered up the pieces of that car, and fortunately we could still drive it, and threw them in the trunk, and we went on our way. We cried about the car, both of us. It was a new car, and it was probably worth about $4,000, and I think I owed around $6,000. But I had possession, and that's the only thing that mattered. But we cried about that. Of course, if I cried about it, then he had to cry, because he's my friend, you know, and it's my car. But this is some of the crazy tricks I did. I came home after this probably a couple of weeks later. I do know this, and this is something that's so strong in my mind. And this is something that flashes before me so many times when I lay down. And I hope to God that I never forget it. Because by this time, our daughters that were living at home, I had already run this one away from home, I told you. She had left and was to never come back. But our daughters that were at home were 7 and 9, our little girls. And it's been a long time since I took those kids. I don't know whether I ever did or not. Took those kids up in my arms and told them I loved them. I wanted to. Oh, God, how I wanted to. But I can remember that day when I drove into the driveway after this long drunk or long trip. I was still drinking. My kids came running across the street. They were playing in somebody else's yard, and they saw the car all ripped apart. And I know they thought, well, my daddy's come home. And they come running across the street to see how bad I was hurt because the car was ripped to pieces. With tears in their eyes. And they ran up to me, possibly 5 or 6 feet from me. They stopped when they took one look at me. And then they gave me that look that we never forget. That look that little children give us. Those eyes, the way they looked at me, they don't look at me like that anymore. But the way they looked at me that day, a deathly fear in their eyes and a forced smile upon their lips, wanting so bad to say something to me. Daddy, was you hurt? Or Daddy, how did it happen? And Daddy, we're glad to see you home. But they don't know what to say because they don't know what my reaction will be. You think we want to live like that? My God, no, I didn't want to live like that. I would have cut this off right here if I could have had the whatever it takes. I don't know what it takes. I don't have the words. But if I could have reached down and put my arms around those little girls and said, I love you. But I couldn't do that. I didn't have it. I didn't have it because I felt unworthy, because I felt dirty, because I had lost all of my self-respect. And I wasn't supposed to live like this because of my background. I wasn't supposed to live like this. I was supposed to live like decent people, comfortable. I knew this. And I didn't like it. Fortunately, this was close to the last because I was introduced to AA shortly after that. I didn't stay sober from the beginning like so many people do. I drank some more, but thank God 10 months later, December the 8th, 1955, I took my last drink up to now. I learned a lot of things on the 8th day of December, 1955. I had checked into one of my usual flophouse hotels in Birmingham. I had been wallowing in my own filth, a bed of my own making for possibly 2 weeks or longer. I don't know. I went in there in November sometime. And it was December the 8th when I came to. It had been a long time since I had woke up. There's a lot of difference from waking up and coming to. But I came to that morning, and I had three terrific sponsors in AA. I had four, but three of them I really relied on. I had a little guy out there in Bessemer called George Garner. He's not with us anymore. We lost him in 1958. 57. He went on to the big meeting, and that's where he's at. But George was one of these godly guys. And it was so long I hated him for it. He'd talk about God a lot when he got up and talked in his AA talk. George had told me a lot of things I should do if I wanted to stay sober. He didn't tell me I had to do them, but he said, if you want to stay sober, here's some things you should do. I had another sponsor that was a big jovial type fellow that told jokes. Had a lot of fun with him. I liked him. Then I had another sponsor that was very stern, very, very stern, very level-headed. When you asked him a question, sometimes it'd take him 5 minutes to make up his mind to give you an answer, but when he gave you an answer, it was the right one, always. And it still is. He's got about 20 years now. He's the daddy of our group out there. He's the one that started it, and he's always there. He's always there. I have a great admiration for a person that keeps coming after all these years. These were my sponsors. They had suggested a lot of things. George had suggested, he said in the big book and in the steps, it mentions about a God of our own standing or a power greater than ourselves. If you're powerless over alcohol, there's got to be another power. Whatever the power is, then turn to this power. And that's what I did on December the 8th, 1955. I asked for sobriety. And I guess this is the only time I ever really asked for it. The only time I ever really asked for it. Because I was granted sobriety that morning. I thought I had a spiritual awakening. You know, I'd been around AA just long enough to where I wanted to have a big deal, just like Bill did, you know. Wanted everything big, white flash. I wanted it to be first class, you know. That's the way us alkies think. And it didn't happen that way. It didn't happen that way. But I got down on my knees in the restroom of this filthy, slimy hotel, and I asked God for sobriety. And I have never made an AA talk in my life but what I don't go to the restroom. And I don't go there for the usual thing. I go there to talk to my God, as I understand it. Because that's where I found him. I found him in a filthy, slimy restroom. The reason I found him there was because I was there. And as far as I'm concerned, that's the only place you're ever going to find him, is where you're at. He's not way off in the great beyond. He's not hid out in the clouds above us or somewhere else. As far as I'm concerned, he's where I am, and he's where you're at. Because you find God where you find people. And where you find people, you find love if you find a people. And that's what God is love. And I found him that morning in that filthy, slimy restroom, and he says, Jim, you've got sobriety if you want it. He didn't talk to me. No. But I had a feeling. I was aware of something. I became aware of this feeling of a choice. I knew I didn't have to drink again if I didn't want to. And I haven't had to. And I still don't have to. I had a spiritual experience that morning. That's what happened to me. I thought I had an awakening. I thought it was the greatest thing that ever happened to a human being. My entire body felt like it was on fire, and immediately I felt good. I didn't go home. I didn't rush home and say, Mickey, I'm never going to drink again. I didn't call my sponsor and say, I'm through with it, brother. I've got it made now. It's all over. But old Jim knew something had happened to him. He knew something had happened to him. I was sick. I had been drunk for 5 months. I was miserable. I didn't have a job. I had a home. I had a house that my wife had maintained. And I called my sponsor and asked him to come and get me and take me home. And that's what he did. He took me home and he put me to bed. And the next spiritual awakening I had or experience, I haven't ever had awakening. The next spiritual experience I had was several days later when I went back to AA. Kind of tough sometimes when you use them up like I used them up down there. But when I walked into the club room, I had that feeling again. The reason I had that feeling was because everybody in that little group, there was about 15 or 16 of them then, every one of them walked up and put their arms around me. And the gals walked up and kissed me and said, Welcome home, Jim. We're glad to have you. Welcome home, Jim. We're glad to have you. This is not a spiritual experience. I don't know what is. And then great things started happening to me because I started reading the big book. I started reading How It Works, A Vision for You, The Family Afterwards, and things like that. I started reading a chapter every night before I went to sleep. And I still do. I like the first part of the big book. That tells you how AA works, what it'll do for you if you'll do what it says to the best of your ability. And of course, when I say you, I'm talking about me, because I can't tell you what to do. But great things started happening to me. I started trying to work the steps of AA the best I could. The best I could. I admitted I was powerless over alcohol, and I knew my life was unmanageable. I knew I'd been insane, but the step told me that it would restore me to sanity. It said it would restore me to sanity if I'd make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the power of God, as I understood it. The power of God, as I understood it. And this is what we have to do. This is what I had to do. Now, I don't, you know, for God's sake, don't get the idea that I let him have it all the time. I don't let him have it all the time because I take over. I still take over. That's the reason I say I'm so responsible and so dependent. Oh, my God, how dependent I am upon my higher power tonight. I think I'm more dependent than I ever was. Because without this, I wouldn't have nothing. Without this, I wouldn't have nothing on earth. And it's so important to me. And how in the world am I going to turn my life and my will and all of these things over to the power of God if I don't know what I got? And the only thing, only way in the world I'm going to know what I got is to make a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. Admit to myself and God and to another human being the exact nature of my wrongs. It falls into place so wonderfully. It's absolutely perfect. It's a perfect program to me. It's not misworded. The steps are not disarranged. They're exactly the way they belong as far as I'm concerned. I started trying to do this to the best of my ability. Started trying to take a part in the club, in the group activities. I started trying to work and try to get on up to the eighth step where we You know, the 8th and 9th, you and me. And I'd been floating around there about 4.5 years on the pinkest cloud that God ever bestowed upon a human being. You know, I hadn't been in AA but just a few short weeks when my youngest daughter forgave me. She was in a little Christmas play out at the grammar school. She was 7 years old. She was quite a performer. She's a ham like her daddy. And she invited me to the Christmas party, a Christmas play at school. And this was important. Brother, you don't know how important unless you got kids, and I don't know a lot of you have. But she invited me to this Christmas play, and I had to go late. But brother, I'd have been there. I'd have been there if I'd have had to cross, because she asked me. And I got there late, and I couldn't find a seat out in the audience, and I had to stand over at the side. This might seem like an awful small and insignificant incident to you, but this was a giant of a thing to happen to this old boy. I walk into that auditorium of that little grammar school, and the play had already started. But when it came my daughter's time to come out on the stage and do her little act, she was going to sing. She started looking all over that little auditorium. Her eyes was just searching the auditorium like this. I know what she was looking for. When that little girl's eyes met mine, she started singing. Up until this point, she had never opened her mouth. And she never took her eyes off of me during that whole performance. I knew she had forgiven me. And we've had a relationship since that night is just too lovely to behold. And after about 4 or 5 years of Mickey and I being in AA, she became active in Al-Anon. Got real with it, you know. Got real with it. And then we had an opportunity to go over to Memphis to go to the Southeastern Convention in 1959 after I'd been in about 4 years. And this oldest daughter of mine lived over there. And she had left 2 years before I got sober. She had called me at the office one day and said, "Daddy, I'm going to go visit my mother." And this was all right. I wanted her to. But I knew she wouldn't come back. She said, "I'll be gone 2 weeks and then I'll be back." But it had been 6 years past. And she hadn't come home. She was 16 years old. She was a young lady. And I hadn't seen her. And I hadn't heard her voice in 6 years. I knew I wasn't deserving. I knew I wasn't worthy because of the way I acted. But God knows I wanted to see that girl. I went over there a lot of times to see her, and I didn't get to. I didn't get to. But somehow I had managed to struggle through the steps. I hadn't worked them and laid them aside, but I had worked them and reworked them and reworked them. And in this ninth step of our program, it says that we made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Except when to do so would injure them or others. And, you know, this is where I have to make a tremendous decision, because the God that I have in this program, and I have a God. Brother, I got one. Because as far as I'm concerned, this is where my God lets me make a decision. You see, it says, except when to do so will injure them or others. And I have to be the judge of whether it will injure those or others. And I had to make amends to this girl. If I lived up to the principles of the AA program, and you told me that I had to do this to the best of my ability. There's a lot of must in this program if we want to stay sober. And I don't like to hear a person say there's no must in AA. There's not if you don't want to stay sober. But there is if you do. There is if I do. So I wrote this little girl a letter and told her I was going to be in Memphis and I'd like to see her. And I didn't get an answer from that letter. But Mickey and I and the other two girls went on to the convention. And I called her up the next morning after we got there, after debating for about 3 hours, whether I would or not. And you see, when we have to do something, when it's compulsory, when it's this strong, when we have to do it, then we got to do it. That's all. So I called her. And the miracles of this program, the miracles of God Almighty, as I understand it, one of them happened that morning. Because, you see, my little girl was 16, but she had another sister that lived there also. But the minute I dialed that number and that receiver was picked up and she said hello, immediately I knew it was my daughter on that phone. I knew that. And I said, "Is this Glenda?" And she said, "Yes, sir." I said, "Do you know who this is?" She says, "Yes, sir. It's my daddy." This was the first time in this child's life that she had ever called me daddy. I said, "Could I come to see you?" And she said, "I wished you would." Mickey and I drove out to see her, and we asked her if she'd like to come down and join us at the conference down at the hotel. And she said she would. We made it all right with her mother, and she rode back downtown with us to the convention. She met a lot of AA people. We didn't have an opportunity to talk too much that day. But I got a smart wife. The next morning, she said, "Jim, see, we took Glenda home that night." And the next morning, she says, "Jim, you go get Glenda yourself this morning. By yourself." Of course, the first thing I thought was, she's lazy and don't want to ride out there with me, you know. Wants to sleep in. How wrong we can be. Because I went out that morning and I picked her up after a long conference. My daughter and I were reunited that day. We have an understanding. We were reunited, and I guess we have a closeness that possibly we wouldn't have had. Maybe that we wouldn't have had. My little girl was a religious person. She was a constant attender of church, and she had gone to her pastor, and she had gone to her principal at high school. Because she had learned that I was in AA. She had learned that I was an alcoholic. And you know what she told me? She says, "Daddy, I wanted to find out what was wrong with you. How can you fail? How can you miss when we've got little children that will go to this extent to find out what's wrong with us? Is this not a spiritual experience? Is this not something that's worth working for? Is this not something worth giving this thing all I've got and being responsible and being dependent upon a creator or a being that will bring this about?" I had an opportunity to give this girl away in marriage. I've given all three of them away in marriage now. Our youngest daughter is 20 years old. And I wouldn't have gotten to give either one of them away if it hadn't been for you. I wasn't ready for him to get married. You know that. I didn't like the bums they was marrying, of course. Wasn't good enough for them. I always resented the God of my understanding up until I found this program that he didn't let me have some sons. He gave me three wonderful daughters. I know how you feel about your kids. I feel the same way. I got the three of the greatest in the world. But you know something? The God of my understanding knew exactly what he was doing, because of this, then they brought me three sons. And I have three son-in-laws that tonight I don't think I could feel any close to them if they were my own sons. He knew exactly what he was doing. I went over to Memphis and I gave my daughter away in marriage, scared to death. Thank God you thought I was getting married again. Way I was shaking. I had to wait out in the, you know how you have to do if you're the father of the bride. You have to wait out in a little room all by yourself. About 10 hours you wait there. Of course, it's actually about 10 minutes, you know. And everybody else marches down this long aisle down between the pews of this tremendous church. And I waited and waited and waited for my time, and they had told me when I was supposed to appear. You know, they give you all your orders about when you're supposed to get there and what you're supposed to do. Well, when all of this anxiety, you talk about anxieties now, brother, I had that right. Frustrations. I didn't perspire, I was sweating. But it was worth it, because when I walked out there and that little girl took a hold of my arm. This was a year later, less than a year later after we were reunited. She was too young to get married. We all know 17's too young. Well, what am I going to do? What am I going to say about it? I've slung her around all of her life. And I'm grateful to her and God Almighty, because she thinks enough of me to let me come over there and be in the wedding. But brother, when she walked out there in that gown, and she takes a firm grip on my left arm, and then she whispers to me, "Daddy, I couldn't do this if you were not here." Things like that. I couldn't do this if you were not here. You know, this is what we've been looking for all of our lives, is to be needed and to be wanted. Because of all of these things, because of all these great experiences, because of the AA program and God is our understanding in you, I don't hurt in here anymore. I don't hurt in here anymore. I don't ever hurt in here anymore. I don't even get mean enough. You know, we can get pretty mean that we're so eaten now that we're sober. Can get pretty low down sometimes, practicing our shortcomings and our character defects that we kind of enjoy. But I don't get mean enough and lousy enough that I hurt in here anymore. I haven't done that bad yet. Because the God of my understanding always shakes me up enough that I come back and I return my will and my life over to Him. I work third step again. And you know, sometimes we make a terrific mistake, and I hope to God you'll forgive me for talking so long. But we make a terrific mistake a lot of times about trying to be too possessive of our people that we love so much. We come so close to losing them. Because you know from the things I've told you tonight, I came so close to not being able to... I almost lost the greatest and most precious heritage that a human being can have, can be bestowed upon it, and that is of being a father. Being a parent. I almost lost them. And I almost never learned how to be a parent. And there's a lot of difference in having kids and being a parent. Now there's one you can chew on. There's a lot of difference in having kids and being a parent. But then after all of these years of sobriety, a couple of 3 years ago, I almost drove the middle daughter out of my life because I became so possessive. I'd tell her where to go, when to go, how to dress, how to do this, how to do that, how to swim, to sit down, when to get up. Any of you ever have that problem? I did. And it almost wrecked our relationship. This was my middle daughter. I've told you about the other two. But my middle daughter got married a year ago, last August. Be 2 years this coming August. She's 22 years old now. And I have pet names for my children, just like you do. This is something between us, you know. And my middle daughter was Princess. She was my princess. I always called her this. Not always, but at times, you know, when we were real close and when we wanted to be real father and daughter. And I had to go back to Memphis again because she had gone over there and met some guy, you know, and was going to get married. She had gone over there to go to school or work, I believe, living with the older daughter and run into another bum, you know, and wanted to get married. But they invited me over. I was going to get to give her away. This boy was a career man in the Navy, and they had a nice wedding out at the base, out at the Naval Air Base. Had to wait in the room again, you know, sweat box. But it was worth it because I overheard a conversation going on outside of that room. And I knew I hadn't done enough. Even with my sobriety now, even with my sobriety, and even all of these things that you people have taught me, and through the grace of Almighty God, all of these things that I should have learned and almost drove this kid out of my life because I did not know how to release with love, you know. You didn't teach me enough, maybe, or maybe I was too hard-headed. But I overheard a conversation that day outside this little sweat box that I was sitting in that reassured me that I hadn't gone too far with this child. And brother, we have a wonderful relationship now. You see, Karen, our younger daughter, was also out there, and they were the only two out in the particular spot where they were, and I was in this little room, sitting in there sweating, waiting for my time. And Karen looked at Nisa, and she says, "Well, Nisa, you're not going to be a Hawkins much longer, you know." And she says, "No, I sure won't. But," she says, "I'll always be my daddy's princess." These are important things to me. This is the things that I got sober for. I got sober for me and for my, for my own good. But I also got sober so I could be reunited with my family. This is what life is about, and this is what we're talking about. We're talking about life. Because AA, we have a little pamphlet over in our area that said, "A Way of Life." A way of life. And that's what it is. That's what it is. See, I was raised in a family where there was a lot of love. There was a lot of love in my family. I've always known what love was, really, if I had just took an inventory and uncovered and took a look. But you had to bring this and make this apparent to me. Make me aware of this. I was raised where there was a lot of love, and I've always known what that was. And through the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, we have raised three wonderful daughters through their temperance teens, and they're happily married. This is satisfaction. This is satisfaction. And for 20-some-odd years now, I've had the greatest little gal, the most courageous little gal that God ever bestowed upon a human being, right by my side, all the way, through the good, through the bad, all the way. And because of that, I know what happiness is. And when you put love and satisfaction and happiness together, it measures up to one thing, and that's wealth. But like our old buddy down on the coast, Bish, says, this kind of wealth doesn't have any dollar marks in front of it. This kind of wealth, you can't walk up to a bar or a counter or a sales counter and reach in your back pocket and buy it. This kind of wealth is not for sale. This kind of wealth we get by practicing the principles of the 12 steps of AA to the best of our ability. I've always known that I was supposed to live like this. AA is doing for me today what alcohol did for me at the age of 13. It's an answer. That's right, it's an answer. AA answered my, alcohol answered my problems in the beginning, and it prepared me for this, and then you got me, and you showed me a loving God of my understanding. And now Alcoholics Anonymous is the answer. And I'm so dependent upon you and upon Almighty God, the Father of all. Thank you.